As you've heard some about already, the theme of this year's UU General Assembly was building a new way. And although the locations, the dates, and the themes of General Assemblies are planned years in advance, that theme of building a new way ended up being particularly relevant to current events in our country and world. The theme of building a new way is also deeply resonant with the history of our movement as UUs. In 1961, when the Universalist Church in America was set to merge with the American Unitarian Association, and they had the separate votes that successfully approved the merger, and then the two groups streamed together into the hall for a joint worship service celebrating the formation in 1961 of the new Unitarian Universalist Association. The processional hymn that they sang included these words: "A freedom that reveres the past but trusts the dawning future more. A freedom that reveres the past, but trusts the dawning future more. Building a new way." As a theologically liberal religious movement, we have the freedom to reach back into the past, to draw wisdom wherever we can find it from the world's religious traditions, but we also have the freedom to balance those traditions with the best insights of 21st century knowledge. We UUs have also long been a part of movements in the larger world, of building new ways of hope and justice in our nation and beyond. And it was wonderful to be on the ground with thousands of UUs on Friday, June 26, when the Supreme Court handed down that landmark ruling, Obergefell versus Hodges. There's so many Supreme Court rulings, but I think Obergefell, right, of all the plaintiffs, right? Obergefell versus Hodges is going to be one of those names that school children learn, just like Brown versus the Board of Education. It's going to be one of those critical cases that is remembered for decades. To share only the conclusion of that remarkable opinion, it says, "They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. The judgment of the Court of Appeals of the Sixth Circuit is reversed. It is so ordered." That decision on June 26, 2015, moving us as a society closer to the dream of our first principle of recognizing the inherent worth and dignity of every person, or maybe of all beings to come, reminded me of a morning precisely 12 years earlier. Some of you may remember where you were as well. June 26, 2003. I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, attending another religious conference. It's what I do. I turned on the news that morning and heard the Supreme Court's ruling in Lawrence versus Texas. The same Justice Anthony Kennedy, then writing for a 6-3 majority, had struck down the sodomy law in Texas and by extension invalidated sodomy laws in 13 other states. One reason that the news of Lawrence versus Texas stopped me in my tracks is that I had just spent the past 3 years in seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, and serving as the graduate assistant all three of those years for that seminary's first out gay professor, who, let's just say, was met during that time with no small amount of discrimination and controversy. So I was stunned to see the tremendous news that the highest court in the land had just made same-sex sexual activity legal in every U.S. state. After I turned off the TV, I went downstairs, and the TV in the hotel lobby, I saw the announcement that Strom Thurmond had died. That news also caused me to shake my head in disbelief. As many of you know, I spent the first 22 years of my life in South Carolina, and for all 22 of those years, Strom Thurmond was my senator. Indeed, he left office 6 months before his death as the only senator to reach the age of 100 while still in office. As you may know, Thurmond famously ran for president in 1948 as the state's rights Dixiecrat candidate and switched his allegiance from the Democratic to the Republican Party to protest the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That's about the same time that South Carolina was putting up the Confederate flag over the State House. Previously in opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1957, Thurmond had conducted the longest filibuster ever by a lone senator at 24 hours and 18 minutes at length, nonstop. And although I didn't know it at that time, the irony was that 6 months after Thurman's death, the news broke that when he was 22, he fathered a child with the family's 16-year-old African-American maid. And although Thurman never publicly acknowledged his daughter, he paid for her education at a historically black college and passed money on to her for some time. But even without knowing at that time that last ironic twist, I still remember the exact words that went through my mind that morning. The world can change. You can have legal gay sex in Texas and Strom Thurmond is dead. Or as we would say in South Carolina, bless his heart. Now, around that time, I also read Andrew Sullivan's now classic book advocating for LGBT rights titled Virtually Normal. In the wake of the recent Supreme Court decision, looking back over the decades of activism in which there was no guarantee that we would ever reach this cultural moment, Sullivan said, "I never believed that this would happen in my lifetime." My book, Virtually Normal, and the hundreds and hundreds of talks and lectures and talk shows and call-ins and blog posts and articles in the 1990s and the 2000s, I thought the book, at least, he writes, would be something that I could leave behind. Secure in the knowledge that his arguments were, in fact, logically irrefutable and would endure past my own death, at least somewhere. But I never, for a millisecond, thought that I would live to be married myself and that it would be possible for everyone, everyone, in America. But it has come to pass in one fell swoop. And he concludes, no hope. No hope. There is still work to be done, including expanded protection for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender citizens to have non-discrimination in housing and employment and many other areas. But we are building a new way. We're also starting to see new signs of hope for building a new way for racial justice in this country. The day after that landmark Supreme Court ruling, I was inspired by the boldness of the activist Bree Newsom in climbing the flagpole outside of the South Carolina State House and removing the Confederate flag. I heard some pushback from some of my fellow South Carolina citizens saying, "Why couldn't she just wait?" Thing is, we've waited way too long already. I was graduating from a liberal arts college in South Carolina in 2000 when the flag was finally removed from on top of the State House and put at the monument where it flew until 2 days ago. So I had a front row seat for that debate in 2000, and Newsom's act of civil disobedience was a strong reminder that taking down the flag was far too long in coming, and it never should have been put up there in the first place, which was done not in the 1860s, but in the 1960s as a symbolic step against the civil rights movement and for white supremacy. And the lies that have been told for too long in the white Confederate apologist version of Civil War history are what created the environment that allowed a 21-year-old boy to commit a mass shooting at Mother Emanuel, the oldest African Methodist Episcopal church in the South. The poet laureate of South Carolina has written prophetically about the Charleston massacre in a poem titled, "When We're Told, We'll Never Understand." She writes, "He is not a lone wolf. He is not alien. He is not inexplicable. He's not just one sick individual. He is one of us. He is from here. He grew up here. He went to school here. He wore his jacket with his white supremacist patches here. He told his racist jokes here. He got his gun here. He learned his racism here. His license plate sported a Confederate flag here. The Confederate flag flies at the state capitol here. This is not unspeakable. We should speak. This is not unthinkable. We should think. This is not inexplicable. We must explain it. He is not a symbol. He is a symptom. He is not a cipher. He is a reminder. His actions are beyond our imagining, but his motivation is not beyond our understanding. No, he didn't get those ideas from nowhere. Mental illness is a way not to say racism. Drug-related is a way to not say hate. Loner is a way to not say one of us. We'll never understand is a way not to look at our history. Here at UUCF and in our communities, we too must speak out, We must explain and we must act to correct injustices at the individual and at the institutional level if we're going to continue to build a new way of love and justice. We must look and see what consciously and unconsciously are we perpetuating that is sexist, that is racist, that is classist, that is heterosexist, and more. For me, the paradigm shifted from how I was taught South Carolina history when I read Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States, not the white Confederate apologist's history of the United States. Zinn's book tells America's story from the point of view and in the words of America's women, factory workers, African Americans, Native Americans, working poor, and immigrant laborers. I commend that book to you, A People's History of the United States, if you haven't read it, or it's certainly worth rereading. A similar shift happened for me when I read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. More than a decade ago, when I first did intensive anti-racism training, I found myself pushing back against the facilitator's claim that there had been no progress on racial justice in this country. I was willing to accept his counterpoint that racism had become more insidious, that had gone a little more underground, but I remained unconvinced that progress had not been made for racial justice. And although I still think there has been significant progress in our country toward dismantling racism, Alexander's book faced me to confront many facts, among them that today there are more African-American adults under correctional control in prison, in jail, probation, or parole than were enslaved in 1850. More than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. We have a prison industrial complex. We have a mass incarceration problem that is deeply racist. But when I see the Confederate flag finally come down from the grounds of the South Carolina State House, I can't help but think that we've at least taken one more step toward building a new way. At the same time, I'm reminded that we are approaching in early August the one-year anniversary of when the 18-year-old black man, Michael Brown, was shot in Ferguson, Missouri, by a white police officer. And I'm reminded of all the other names: Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Gardner, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, and so many more. But these injustices are also galvanizing a Black Lives Matter movement, and that, like Brees Newsom's act of civil disobedience, is rising up to dismantle systemic racism in our country. As the South Carolina-born poet Nikki Finney wrote after the vote to remove the Confederate flag from the State House grounds, "We are not free to go on as if nothing happened yesterday, not free to cheer as if all our prayers have finally been answered today. We are free only to search the yonders of one another's faces as we pass by, tip our hat, hold a door ajar, asking silently, who are we now? If we, the living, do not give our future," remember that part about revering the past but trusting the dawning future more, she writes, "Who are we now? If we, the living, do not give our future the same honor as the sacred dead of then and now, we lose everything. What new human cosmos can be made of this tempest of tears, this upland of inconsolable jubilation, in all our lifetimes, finally, this towering, undulating moment is here. We are building a new way." As Dr. King wrote decades earlier, "This is where we are. Where shall we go from here? First, we must massively assert our worth and dignity. We must stand up amidst a system that still oppresses and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on." Echoing Dr. King, Cornel West in his Ware lecture said, "Tenderness is what love looks like in private, but justice is what love looks like in public. We must build a new way."